evening and welcome to another edition of Gillespie here on FTRradio.com. Thanks for tuning in this evening. We have a great show. Tonight we have on the show John LaRosa. He is a new media guru. He did a lot of work on the Sean Bielak campaign. Remember the dancing Barney Frank? He was involved with that. We also talk with Amelia Hamilton. You may know her on Twitter as the Gadsdenista. We get her perspective on the CR, the shutdown, the upcoming Paul Ryan budget, $6.2 million in cuts. It's going to be a fun show tonight. But I want to talk a little bit about the CR that's coming up, a little bit about the budget. Ronald Reagan once said, "Government always finds a need for whatever money it gets." While government greed could certainly be considered to be a bipartisan problem, for the past 2 years, our government has looked at us taxpayers in much the same way that Michael Moore looks at a Las Vegas buffet. As a matter of fact, during his time in office, President Barack Obama has treated taxpayers with an unprecedented level of contempt. In the viewpoint and narrow ideology of our president, no American works hard enough to achieve their own goals. We simply take advantage of those who weren't so fortunate. With the contradictory ignorance of Nobel laureate Paul Krugman playing the role of chief propagandist, this administration has "yes we can" its way towards a complete fiscal collapse. As a result, voters presented a stunning rebuke of historical proportions to the extreme liberal agenda of the Democratic Party thanks to a slate of Republican candidates who ran on a platform of fiscal conservatism. Marco Rubio, Rand Paul, Todd Young, and their freshman colleagues on the Hill came to Washington to provide the adult leadership our nation desperately needs. It is in this new era of fiscal conservative Republican Party that the recent debates over our budget crisis took place the past few weeks. The most important point to be made in this discussion is that the Democrats, who control both the House and the Senate on top of the presidency until the 2010 elections, actually refused to pass a budget. That's right, I said refused. They knowingly and willfully failed to pass a budget, which is the primary responsibility of Congress. But Nancy Pelosi's House, no doubt with guidance from the Obama White House, simply refused to pass what likely would have been a budget full of epic tax increases and even more massive deficits during an election year. Ironically enough, out of fear that voters would tag Democrats as the party of higher taxes and ginormous deficits. So within this new framework of fiscally conservative GOP, House Speaker Boehner led a budget negotiation that radically changed the discussion in D.C. Whereas in past years, the discussions would center around how much the budget should increase for the coming year, this budget negotiation was notable for the fact that the discussion became just how much should be cut. That's an historic change that should give hope to those of us who fear the coming fiscal calamity and desperately hope to do something before it's too late. Indeed, this budget accomplishes some extraordinarily important objectives, and I hope you'll bear with me as I list a few highlights. 1. It is the largest non-defense spending cut in American history. The agreement will enact the largest non-defense spending cut in dollar terms in American history and the biggest overall reduction since World War II. Number 2. Hundreds of billions in spending cuts over the next decade. This agreement will cut hundreds of billions of dollars from the federal budget over the next decade. Number 3. Officially ends the stimulus spending binge. The agreement begins with the reversal of the stimulus spending binge that began in 2009, signaling the official end of a period of unprecedented government intervention. 4. It sets the stage for trillions more in spending cuts. This clears the way for congressional action on the House Budget Committee Chairman Paul Ryan's budget, which cuts $6.2 trillion in spending and restores our path to fiscal sanity. It also defunds, number 5, defunds the Obama administration's czars for healthcare, autos, climate change, and urban affairs. This agreement denies federal funding for the salaries and expenses for 4 of the Obama administration's most controversial czars. And 6, it reduces Congress's own budget. The agreement cuts the legislative branch by $103 million over last year's level. It is crucial to remind everyone that the American people have just won the largest real dollar spending cut in American history. To help create a better environment for job creation, House Republicans successfully negotiated nearly $40 billion in Washington spending cuts for the rest of fiscal year 2011, just months after President Obama asked Congress for a spending freeze that would mean zero cuts. Think about that. We just went from zero cuts, which the president wanted. We got him to cut $40 billion. But in an attempt to prove correct the old adage that no good deed should go unpunished, a certain small segment of voters seems to feel as if the deals successfully negotiated by Speaker Boehner either didn't go far enough or was a complete cop-out. While we used to laugh at such naive and unrealistic notions, the sad reality is that an unrealistic view of how government now operates has brought far too many into the growing tent known as the Republican Party. Now, I'm all for growing the Republican Party and expanding the tent, but some of these people are calling House Republicans things like cowards and sellouts for getting the most liberal president in American history to agree to the largest non-defense spending cut in history. It's as if they forget all that has happened in 6 months since the November elections, including getting President Obama to extend the Bush-era tax cuts across the board, forcing him to break one of his biggest campaign promises. It's as if they are missing a continent-sized forest for just a few trees. I know Ronald Reagan once said something about the person who agrees with you 80% of the time is friendly and an ally, something that I mostly agree with. But when that 20% includes a refusal to see the reality of the extraordinary work done by Speaker Boehner and House Republicans, then I'm thinking the Gipper might even disagree with himself on that quote from time to time. Well, if that just didn't get your blood boiling, we got a heck of a lot more coming up. And trust me, we talk about the other side of the issue. I'm not going to shut the people out. I know there are going to be people out there who are going to disagree with that, what I just said, but I'm going to give them a chance to speak their mind. Coming up, we'll be speaking with John LaRosa of Four Tier Strategies. He is, like I said, a new media guru and has some plenty of insights coming into what should shape up for 2012 as a new media frenzy presidential campaign. And then we'll speak with the Gadsdenista, Amelia Hamilton of Fountainhead Communications. We get her perspective on the CR, on the shutdown that almost was, and so much more. So stick around. We have plenty of action here on Gillespie. You're listening to FTRradio.com. We'll be right back after these messages.
Hey, Gillespie fans. This is Fingers Tiberius Molloy. Listen to The Snark Factor with Fingers Molloy every Wednesday at 9 p.m. Eastern Time only on FTR Radio. And check out my website, FingersMolloy.com.
Welcome back to Gillespie here on FTRradio.com. Thanks for joining us. With us this segment, we have Christy Kelly, and she has brought a special guest, one of the foremost new media specialists within the political sphere, John LaRosa. John, thanks for being on the show.
Thanks for having me on.
Well, Christy, tell us a little bit about John.
Well, John has experience in a wide range of fields, including real estate, banking, sales management, marketing, and new media. He's the former vice president of two companies. He's a longtime business consultant who has advised in many verticals and levels, from the mom-and-pop startups to CEOs of mid-sized companies. And John started focusing exclusively on politics just before the Brown campaign. And if you can remember the great hashtag 41st vote.
Yes.
On Twitter, he was the creator, and that certainly got my attention. That's how I met John. He is also he was the director of social media and online fundraising for Sean Bealot for Congress, who ran against Barney Frank. And he also and John won for his efforts on that campaign. He won the Aristotle Award. And now he is the co-founder of Four Tier Strategies alongside Brad Marston, after the 2010 elections. Thanks so much for joining us, John.
Well, again, Chrissy, thanks for inviting me. And I'm blushing now on this other end just listening to that. I didn't know I was so good.
Well, fabulous.
Yes. Well, you do have quite the impressive bio. Tell me, real quick, were you the brains behind the dancing Barney Frank?
No, actually, that was Lad Ellinger at Film Lad, who did the Barney Shuffle. I did bring Lad into the campaign because I thought it needed a little bit of pop, especially on the viral side and the social media end, just to drive Twitter followers, get some attention, maybe irritate some people on the left so that they would start commenting and inadvertently drive more attention and money to Sean.
Well, that you were a winner on all fronts there. Tell us, what were your roles with the BLOC campaign? I think you really, and Sean really kind of impressed and startled a lot of people with just how well he was able to perform in that race. Granted, unfortunately, he came up a little bit short, but he gave Barney quite the scare.
He did. He also basically bankrupted Barney and prevented his money from going elsewhere.
Wait a minute. You're saying that Barney wasn't bankrupt, like personally, morally, whatever, or you just talking financially?
Well, the other side, the actual financial side, he played a role. Barney had to dig into his own wallet for $200,000 to donate to the campaign, and he brought Clinton in. He pulled out all the stops for this campaign. That was actually a favor to Sean by bringing Clinton in. But he really got him a little scared. And what happened with Sean was that nobody here knew who Sean was. Nobody in Massachusetts knew who Sean was. He was a first-time candidate, 35-year-old Marine, who had done some work with iRobot and done some consulting. But really, nobody in the Mass GOP really knew Sean. So my job was actually to nationalize the campaign. It helped that it was Barney Frank, who's not particularly well-liked across the country. So we jumped on Twitter and Facebook, and I focused on Twitter and actually tried to push, not numbers per se, because we really didn't have a lot of time by the time he brought me in to do that, but the conservative blogosphere. So I got low-level bloggers to actually start writing stories about this, and I pushed the viability of this guy in the campaign. So the previous gentleman who ran against Barney Frank lost by 38%, which is amazing, given that it's Barney Frank. But you got to understand Massachusetts.
Yeah. Wow.
It's a very gerrymandered district, and Sean ended up losing by 10%.
Wow. Really,
so he got all the way up to Fox News, which generated quite a bit of income. A lot of that had to do with me groveling to my blogger friends, like folks like Stace McCain, the other McCain, saying, you got to write about this guy. He has a chance. Barney was the single reason, of anyone, the biggest cause of this financial meltdown between Barney Frank and Chris Dodd. And we've got to do something about it. And I, without two towns out of 29, Barney's hometown, Sean lost 90% to 10% in Barney's town.
Wow.
So without that town and the one next to it, it's a dead heat. Sean actually won, I believe it was 17 out of 29 towns in the district, and that was pretty impressive for a first-time candidate. And a lot of that had to do with his regular boots on the ground people, his campaign management, the people that made phone calls, all that. But he wouldn't have had the money without the national attention. We've raised over $1 million online.
That's excellent. And now that we are turning our attentions to the 2012 campaign, and we see that Barack Obama's already got his campaign launched, and they're having to take a different tactics than they did in 2008.
Well, I think he's going to add on to the tactics he used. He was widely credited with running a great social media campaign in 2008, especially motivating young voters to get out and vote. I think he's going to do more of the same, but he's also doing a lot of other things that are more technical, and also paying through OFA, paying people to create fake accounts to drive his traffic. And this is public. It's not even private. That's not even inside information. This has been widely reported. So he's going to use some of the tools he used before, you know, capturing email, sending out, Google and Facebook ads are much more sophisticated now and much more highly targeted. So he can get the people that are more inclined to vote for him for some reason. I don't know why they would, but he's identified people who would, who drink lots of Kool-Aid.
Yeah. But, well, John, I've noticed that is when he launched his campaign, Politico, not necessarily known as one of the most bipartisan publications out there, but they ran a story on the launch of his new website and how it was integrating Facebook even more so, and that they're going to be abandoning some of the things of the 08 campaign and focusing a lot more on things like Facebook. And now you go to his website, and instead of showing you friends that like him, they show you friends who aren't liking him, so as to kind of swell their numbers.
Honestly, I hadn't seen that. They're just showing totals of people that have expressed any type of commentary.
It seemed fascinating that it seems as if the model campaign, new media wise, is an ever changing thing. And of course, for some reason, the author of the article seemed to say that blogs and emails are passe. As one who is living in new media, I mean, what's your take on that? As a blogger, I'm actually kind of offended.
The blogosphere is not passe because everybody uses the blogs as content links.
Mm-hmm.
And bloggers themselves don't make any money unless they get hits on advertising. So they're, you know, shameless self-promoters out there, and they're
yes,
driving the message. What is going to happen more, and we mentioned Ladd and the Barney shuffle there, what is going to happen more, I think you're going to see more and more viral video. You're going to see Mitt Romney just announced his exploratory committee, and to a lot of Z's, you know, on Twitter.
Yeah, yeah.
It was not met with lots of enthusiasm, but because he never stopped running from 08, so it's not a surprise. He launched with a video which was very dull and essentially just Mitt talking to the camera. I think you'll start seeing some more creative videos for launches to attract attention, to capture pledges and email addresses. So email, it's not passe. They're just going to add to the arsenal of social media tools.
Mm-hmm. It seems to me that...
Facebook lighting, Google ads are far more sophisticated now, so they're going to do some more of that stuff. But you still need the content to be shared. So the bloggers are not insignificant. And, you know, hat tip to my friend Stacey McCain, who's always up there, in the Dan Reels world and, Hot Air and that other Gillespie guy, you know, and the Morrissey guy. And, you can go through the whole list of kind of high-end political bloggers. That they drive the traffic, and the media, especially Fox, they read the Breitbarts, they read all that stuff, and that's where they get their info and say, oh, look at this story. That's how the candidates get some airtime.
Yeah.
So it's very important. That's what I did with Sean. It was not so much, oh, God, we need 40 more followers today to hit 300. Yay.
Mm-hmm.
You know, who cares? And it was also not, Sean is standing here, please donate, give me money. There was this engagement from the campaign, and I think you'll see a little bit more of that, some more fun stuff, maybe like some quizzes. Facebook, you can do polling now, so polling always drives a lot of traffic.
Anything that you can interact, that people can interact with. I think one of the things that I've noticed is whereas Barack Obama's big motivation was to get the people to go to his website, now it seems that with the way Facebook is so the explosion of Facebook and Twitter, and that's where everybody is. So now the candidates can go directly to the people instead of trying to get them to come to them. Everybody's kind of congregates in one place now.
Right, and you're also going to see more groups of kind of pseudo-affiliated groups saying, you know, draft so-and-so for president. I know there's a draft Herman Cain. There's a draft, you know, go through the list of people who aren't actually announced yet. They have somewhat affiliated or not affiliated groups always pushing that. So you have the group function that's going to be pushed more. You're going to have more interactive stuff like, hey, make your own video about why you support candidate X and send it to us, and then we'll play it on our site to 4 million people. So they're going to be trying to encourage more interaction so people feel more a part of the process as opposed to, oh, God, he's hitting me on it again.
Yeah.
So that's I mean, you'll see more and more of that.
John, we just have a few minutes left. How do you see the 2012 campaign shaping up on the new media scale, and how do you see it differing from 2008? I know that's quite a bit there to kind of talk about. But
I think it's early. The famous people, quote unquote, you know, Donald Trump, Sarah Palin, Michelle Bachmann, the followers. I actually took a little time and went through a list. If you actually went by numbers, Newt Gingrich has 1.3 million plus million followers on Twitter.
Wow.
Obama has 7.3 million plus followers on Twitter. And then if you just go down the list, Sarah Palin has 478,000 on Twitter, but 2.8 million on Facebook. So if you just went by numbers, you say, okay, these are the clear winners, but it's really who's following you and why they're following you.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, someone like Mitch Daniels, who has some support at Deanna there, I know Christy, he's not doing much at all on Twitter. He has about 46,000 Facebook followers. But Mitt Romney has 33,000 followers on Twitter, about 40,000 Facebook likes. But Herman Cain, who I mentioned, just started. He's already up to about 62,000 Facebook likes.
Hmm.
So it's all about creating perception of momentum, and it's really whoever said bloggers are passe, I disagree with entirely. So you're going to see a lot of folks just, you know, they're just starting out. So if they're not announced, they're not going to pay a social media team to come in. I think that's a mistake personally, but that's self-interest too.
Yeah.
they're not going to pay a ton of money to have a really sophisticated team to come in at this point if they're not really going to announce, you know, and they're just floating their name out there so they can do some fundraising with big, high-end donors and things like that, in a more traditional approach. So I think once you start, the field starts narrowing and people say, oh, I got to do this. We got to spend some money on this. These people are way ahead. You're going to start seeing a more active social media effort. You know, Michelle Bachmann's cranking on social media. And she has a core group. She's got like 216,000 Facebook friends, and she's posting frequently.
Wow.
You know, my favorite politician on social media, though, is not a candidate this year. It's Fred Thompson.
I love Fred.
He's one of the funniest politicians on social media. I just go to his page.
He is excellent.
Yeah, he's like the Dennis Miller of former candidates. So I really like his stuff because it's different. It's not just saying, you know, Obama is bad or this one is stupid or, you know, check out this graph on, you know, the debt. I mean, we see enough of that, that it's nice to have a little refreshing touch. That's kind of what I try to do with Sean as well.
If only Fred Thompson had taken to campaigning like he has to social media.
Oh, I know.
Exactly.
I was huge Fred head in 08.
Yeah, that was kind of bizarre that he didn't really do much.
Yeah.
It was just like, well, what are you doing? Are you running for president or are you just kind of cruising around?
Well, you know, I've heard everyone has their story about what they heard in the Thompson campaign. I had some loose connections to it, but it was just unfortunate that it didn't take off. You know, it's part of it does make me wonder that if Fred had really been aggressive, if the primary would have turned out differently. I was a huge Fred head myself. I thought he was the most principled, the most most representative of fiscal and even social conservative beliefs.
Yeah, I liked him. Plus, he had a presence from being an actor. So,
oh, yeah.
you know, he
huge charisma.
He could have stood up to the cameras throughout if he were so inclined. It just seemed like, I mean, the perception was he probably was at a million events that we don't know about.
Yeah.
You know, private events, and he flushed it out and said, you know what, I'm not getting the enthusiasm privately. So he probably lost the public interest, you know, his public enthusiasm.
Yeah.
So I don't know him personally, but I just thought he going back to his feed, both on Twitter and Facebook, it's pretty much the same thing. It's just hysterical. So that's a part of the day that just goes by quickly when we do stuff.
So the political follow recommendation of the day is Fred Thompson. Make sure to follow Fred Thompson on Twitter and Facebook.
Absolutely. No question about it.
Well, John,
of course, me, I'm Christy Kelly, at Christy Kelly. You know,
yes, where can they find you on Facebook and Twitter, John?
I just sent you a friend request on Facebook.
Yes, I have accepted already during the course of this interview.
Already?
Yes.
We are multitasking here.
Yes.
My personal account is at JSL Consulting, all one word, lowercase, and my business account is at 4-Tier Strategies with the number 4.
Mm-hmm. Excellent.
And that's my new company. I've really founded after the election. So.
Well, John, thank you for being our guest this week. We really appreciate your time. I hope that we can have you on again.
Because it went by too quickly.
It did. It really did. And frankly, I know that this cycle is going to explode on the new media scene. If 2008, I mean, we saw things happening in 2006, and then, you know, it really burst onto the scene in 2008, and I really think it's just going to explode even further.
It absolutely will, no question about it.
And I'm really
the politicians are waking up to the need. They just don't know what they're buying.
Well,
I got to do something with this. Someone help me.
That's right, John. Thanks for being on the show this week.
All right,
yes, John. It's always been a pleasure.
And you're
okay,
listening.
Take care, Christy.
You're listening to Gillespie here on FTR Radio. We'll be right back. Hey there, FTR Radio fans. This is Josh Gillespie, host of Gillespie, airing every Tuesday night at 10 p.m. I want to tell you about the Shoutcast app. Download it to your favorite smartphone today. Then search for FTRradio.com. Never miss your favorite FTR show again. This is a must-have for any FTR listener. Download the Shoutcast app today.
Hey, fellow conservatives. When you're drinking your overpriced coffee or a Moco Choco whatever in the wacko latte at Starbucks, you ever feel like you're the only conservative in there? That's because you probably are. But don't feel bad, as you can annoy the bejesus out of those pesky Moonbat, New York Times, and Daily Coast reading liberals by reading HoosierAccess.com. At HoosierAccess.com, you can read the latest thought and opinion from conservatives in the crossroads of America. Annoy the Moonbats. At HoosierAccess.com to your favorites today.
And welcome back to Gillespie here on FTRradio.com. Thanks for tuning in this evening. With me this segment, we have Amelia Hamilton. You may know her on Twitter as the Gadsdenista. She is with Fountainhead Communication, and she contributes to a good number of conservative websites and blogs. Amelia, thanks for being on the segment this time.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, I wanted to have you on because... you have, one, because of your involvement with all these conservative outlets, one, you have, I'm guessing, a pretty good finger on the pulse of some of the Tea Party groups and some of the other conservative outlets out there. I mean, I'm a blogger with you, but, you know, I like to get other people's opinion, and with all the events that have been going on in Washington, within the last couple of days, I'd love to kind of pick your brain on this and kind of get what are your thoughts on the CR, the almost shutdown that occurred? Did we get enough? Did we not get enough? You know, what are your thoughts on this? It's kind of a lot of area to cover there.
It is. It's a big question. No, I don't think that we got enough. I don't know how much more we could have gotten, and I know that we're sort of being branded as a big mean party now, which doesn't really bother me at all.
I know, oh boo-hoo, we asked for too much.
We're terrible people living within our means.
I know. Goodness.
So, I guess that's what really bothers me, is I live within my means. I just don't understand.
Well, you're a small business owner, so you know what it means to live within a budget.
Right. I do not have a credit card. If I don't have the money, I don't buy it. It's that easy.
Wow.
Yeah, so I don't really understand. I guess we will see what happens. I'm loving Paul Ryan right now. Big crush.
Yeah, he's a rock star right now. I mean, you know, here's the thing, for all the guff that Republicans are getting in Congress right now, and trust me, I understand it. I do. It has to say something, and I hope that it does to the mass public out there that, you know, I know we're it sounds like Republicans, and especially leadership, have been asking for a small amount. But when you hear Paul Ryan's budget, and he's saying, let's slash $6.2 trillion.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, we're $14.2 trillion in debt.
I know.
And we're looking at already slashing 6.2. Now, granted, I mean, if Democrats are willing to shut down government over a measly $39 billion,
right?
What are they going to do with this?
I don't know. And about the shutdown, if they were that concerned about it, they could have bothered at least proposing a budget of their own.
You bring up a good point, because, I mean, you know, yeah, Democrats, they had control of the House and Senate and the White House last year, and
they had a great shot, and they did nothing.
Well, you know, it's funny to me. You know, they got spooked by the election. And so instead of doing something, you know, and trying to have a leg to stand on,
right,
they chickened out.
They did, and lost anyway.
They did. Now, you're based in Colorado, is that correct?
That is correct.
Oh, God's country, I tell you. I've only spent 3 months of my life out there, but it was the greatest summer of my life.
Oh.
And well, I would return in a heartbeat if I could.
Yeah.
Oh, man. But they have a pretty good conservative Tea Party movement going on in Colorado. What's the people that you're talking to, that you're interacting with on, because you... contribute to the Landmark Report, was it?
Yep.
The Landmark Report, the Right Sphere,
and Liberty Inc.
I'm sorry, what?
And Liberty Inc., which
is Liberty Inc., yes.
A magazine here in Colorado that's a blog now.
Fantastic, yes. So what's the word on the street, you know, that, you know, did you guys want to see it shut down? Did you want to see government just come to a screeching halt? Which, again,
you know,
to a certain degree, I can understand.
A lot of people did. I'm not going to pretend that we didn't get together and go out for a few drinks on Friday night to possibly celebrate. But the one thing that was on everybody's mind, I think, was we don't mind, really, if the government shuts down, but the military has got to get paid and Congress must not get paid.
Mm-hmm.
That, and, you know, just the feeling of not understanding, if we're going to shut down non-essential functions of government, and I know this has been said before, but why do they exist then? If they're not essential, let's just shut them down and not bring them back.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I've said it before on this show before that I am a federal employee. Mm-hmm. And so I thought that we did do a kind of a terrible job defining what exactly is essential and non-essential. And, you know, government in general has a very, it does a poor job of explaining, well, a lot of things. And the necessity of a lot of things. So what was funny is that, you know, by one person's standard of essential is different than another's. Because, for instance, every single member of Congress was allowed to decide who they felt was essential and non-essential. And now, that basically means that the people who are essential for making sure that the office stays open and that the congressman can do his job in terms of, you know, being on the floor and whatnot. But then the people who are considered non-essential in a time of a shutdown or a slowdown, they're basically your caseworkers. So, you know, casework gets shut down. And you want to know why casework gets shut down? It gets shut down because the administration, who controls whether the military is essential or non-essential, which sounds crazy, honestly. But, again, I was just basically making the case that we do a poor job of explaining what is essential and non-essential.
Yeah.
But the thing is that you guys do make a good point. And it was, and as in federal employees, we were hearing what the people were saying. You know, if you're non-essential, why are you even employed?
Right.
And honestly, it kind of made us wonder, you know, how do we define ourselves?
Yeah.
So, but anyway, I mean, that aside, you know, so the government doesn't shut down. We're getting our apparently, hopefully, now there's rumors today that we could be going into, we could be in for another shutdown. Goodness knows, oh gosh. You just can't come to an agreement for longer than a couple of hours, it seems, in Washington.
No.
But, you know, Republicans, you know, they seem to have been willing to stick around for a stand for $39
billion. Right.
Are they willing, do you think they're going to be willing to take that stand for the $6.2 trillion?
I hope so. You know, I think that they will, and I hope that they will.
But I guess as a constituent, what do you want to see cut? You know, if we're using the number 6.2, we know Paul Ryan is putting some things together. But you as a constituent, what do you want to see cut?
I want to see everything cut that is not an enumerated power in the Constitution.
Okay, well that's pretty broad. Okay, that includes the Department of Education. Which, I mean, even President Reagan was set to abolish that.
Yep.
Well, he wanted to. Obviously didn't get around to it, but he wanted to.
Yeah, well, they are out of control. They can go.
That's right. Department of Homeland Security.
Department of Defense can handle that.
Okay. No, I hear you. And that is an enumerated power by the Constitution.
Yep.
I heard today that czars were cut. Apparently not all of them, but some czars were cut. What's your general feeling about that?
Works for me.
Works for you. I mean, and it was a way for the president and previous presidents. We can't say that Barack Obama is the first one to do this.
No, not at all.
But it has been a way for presidents to kind of skirt the Senate for confirmation on certain guys.
Yes. A lot of these things are not Obama's fault. They've been building and building and... Mm-hmm. But let's just take care of it now.
Yeah. Well, outside of the number that you're seeing, I mean, obviously the general $6.2 trillion, what about the Ryan plan do you like the most?
I like that it's just sort of reality-based. It takes on some real changes. It deals with Medicare, which is getting out of control. It's cutting taxes. It's just getting back to putting money in the hands of the earners. I think it's going to create jobs. I think it's going to stimulate the economy. It puts a lot more power in the hands of the states and the individuals, and that's where we need to go.
Mm-hmm.
And then well, the hands off my grandma people, but...
I mean, Democrats automatically say that we're out to kill people with this. I mean, in short order, that's what they're saying.
Yeah, we're going to kill women with Planned Parenthood.
Yeah, that's right. You know, we're going to steal Planned Parenthood's money. I mean, forget the fact that they're killing babies.
I don't care about females in the womb.
That's right. And we're out to kill women, and we're out to kill grandma and grandpa.
Yeah, well, I've got that sewn on a pillow on my couch.
I like it. Are there shirts available at all? You know,
there should be.
Well, you know, I'm going to kind of switch gears on here on you because I hear that you are also an author.
It's true.
And you have a children's book coming out. We're completely switching gears here.
Yeah.
Now, is this a children's book that teaches kids about the founding fathers, or what kind of book are we looking at here?
It is a counting book about America. It's called One Nation Under God, A Book for Little Patriots. And it's a counting book 1 through 10, starting with One Nation Under God and going through to 10 amendments in the Bill of Rights.
Really?
Really.
That is so cool. Now, as a father of three, and my oldest one is five, my youngest, who is two, she just started learning to count.
Yeah.
And this sounds like a perfect idea, because it seems to ingrain just some of America's founding principles.
Yes.
Into education here.
Yep. And actually, I wrote it for my friend's little boy for his third birthday, so.
Oh, very cute. Now, has it been published yet, or are we still in the stages?
We're on track for a 4th of July release, so.
Oh, well, you planned that perfectly.
I did. I didn't even mean to. It actually got pushed back, but it's even better now, so.
Even when
things don't go to plan.
That's right. Now, what kind of distribution are we looking at? Are we going to be able to find it on Amazon? Do you have a particular website? Is there a Gadsdenista website outside of Fountain Communications? Or Fountainhead, excuse me, Communications?
Not yet.
Okay.
So just keep checking my Twitter feed. There will be one launching soon. We're still figuring that out. And then it's going to be, it should be on Amazon. We'll be able to buy it through my website. And it's going to be in a lot of local bookstores, and then we'll start going after the big guys.
Are you looking at hopefully maybe like a Christmas time, big time, you know, hitting everywhere?
That would be wonderful.
Oh, I'm liking this. What are some of the other features in this book? Do you hit some of the founding fathers? What other parts of the Declaration or the Constitution in this?
Well, there's just a lot about the founding principles. So it gets into the founding fathers and the sort of the beliefs in the Constitution, and just sort of what it's American exceptionalism, which I guess we're not supposed to talk about anymore. But
yeah, because clearly, I mean, if you're exceptional, keep that to yourself.
Exactly. Wouldn't want anyone to know.
That's right. Well, this is just fascinating.
Yeah, and I found incredible illustrators, so the pictures are great, and it's going to be wonderful.
Well, this is great. Well, again, we can find Amelia at her website, which is fountainheadcommunication.com. Mm-hmm. Additionally, you can follow her on Twitter, and I strongly recommend following her on Twitter, because she gets big dogs responding to her. I'm telling you, you know, I foolish me, I only started following you last night.
I know.
And that was at the behest of Barragond on Twitter. But
yep.
When you're hanging around and chatting with the likes of Steven Cruiser, I have to believe you elevate Steven Cruiser.
Thank you.
But I definitely heard your name being your Twitter handle, if you will. Well, bandied about at a BlogCon event that we had here in Indianapolis. A couple weeks ago, sponsored by FreedomWorks, and Cruiser was in town, and more than once I heard the Twitter name Gadsdenista. Fortunately, it wasn't in vain. He was speaking very highly of you, and I was like, I gotta follow this person. Why am I not doing this yet?
And BlogCon is here next year.
That is right.
Oh. Yes. I can't wait.
You know, that alone is worth it for me to drive out to Denver. Yes, God's country is what... Is Colorado. I love it. I just, seriously, I gush when I talk about Colorado. I mean, I'm a lifelong Hoosier. I will live and die in this state. This is home, but it was seriously a slice of heaven, and I'm not joking. When I was out there, it was honestly like I was touching heaven.
Yeah, it's wonderful. I miss the Great Lakes.
Are you originally a Michigander, or...
Born in Indiana, but grew up in Michigan.
You were born in Indiana, so you're a native Hoosier?
I am Hoosier born.
Bless you! So you... Oh, you do have a bit of home in you. That's wonderful. I feel like all of a sudden we're a little bit closer, just because I know you're Hoosier born. Well, anyway, again, follow Amelia on Twitter at Gadsdenista. Check out her website, fountainhead.com. And what was the name of your book again that we'll be looking for?
One Nation Under God, A Book for Little Patriots.
Are you available on Twitter? I mean, on Facebook, excuse me? Yeah, obviously you're on Twitter.
My fan page hasn't launched yet, either, for the book.
All right, all right.
So all that should be the next few weeks.
Be on the lookout. Amelia, thank you for your time and for your inaugural appearance on Gillespie. And obviously, this is actually the first time we've spoken together. So I love the input that you've given me as a federal employee. Listening to the people, that's what we're supposed to do, right?
Yep.
You're our boss. That's right. Amelia, thank you.
All right, thanks, Josh.
All right, you're listening to Gillespie here on FTRradio.com. We'll be right back. You look at me.
FTR Radio is from the right radio. Online at FTRradio.com.
Welcome back to Gillespie here on FTRradio.com. Hey, thanks for tuning in this evening. We had a great show. My thanks go to John LaRosa and Amelia Hamilton, Gadsdenista on Twitter. Check out Amelia's book. This is going to be a great thing. And it's phenomenal that people are getting involved this way and teaching history to even our youngest. You know, sometimes we'll have fundamental differences, but at the end of the day, I think that, you know, people like Amelia and I can agree on a lot of things. And she's leading a good movement and a part of a great movement, especially there in Colorado. Especially want to give thanks to John LaRosa for being on. His insight on what is going on in the world of new media and how it's going to affect the 2012 election. Just exciting, exciting. Well, I want you guys to stick around. Coming up next is the Armchair Energist. And then at 11 p.m. Pacific time, 2 a.m. Eastern time, just before Red Eye, the Jenny Erickson show will be on. Tonight she is having Kevin McKeever of Bank of Kev Productions. If you were at CPAC, you went to the Go Proud party, well, Kevin McKeever and Bank of Kev Productions were there. Go to bankofkev.com and you can check out some of the pictures that were taken at that event. It was a good time. I remember that. Well, anyway, also wanted to remind you to check out Gillespie on iTunes, where you can download previous episodes. And always, would love for you to go and like Gillespie on Facebook. Go to facebook.com/Gillespie on FTR Radio. And with that, thanks for tuning in this week. Again, Armchair Energist coming up next, Jenny Erickson later tonight. Thanks again, and we'll see you again next week. You've been listening to Gillespie here on FTRradio.com. Good night.